coming to you live from inside the globe, perched high atop the Bugle Planet building in sunny Gotham City. It's Hey Kids Comics with two guys who are always ready to seduce the innocent, your hosts, Andrew Farmer and the Jedi Cole Houston. And now it's time for Hey Kids Comics.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Hey Kids Comics. I am Andrew Farmer. With me tonight, as always, the Jedi Cole Houston.
Yes, indeed. And we're going to get editorial this week.
that's one way to put it. We got a good one tonight. We've been building to this for the last four issues, and I think the last year and a half since Cole blew our mind with a...
observation of sorts.
Oh my God, it was amazing when you said it. It didn't even dawn on me that it was true until you said it, and I think everybody was just floored when it happened. So we find ourselves at the end of Roguish Eyes 2.
Tangled Web.
All the Spider-Man villains, and so far, this is it. This is the culmination. This is the man we're referring to as Peter Parker's Joker.
Yes, indeed. This is the most significant of his foes, of all of the deadly foes of Spider-Man.
That's right.
As it were.
And so far, who have we gone through so far?
Well, we kick things off with, of course, the Green Goblin, because that's sort of Spider-Man's low-hanging fruit.
Yes, it is. And then we went to Sandman, I believe, right?
Yes, indeed. Following Sandman with another classic.
My new favorite.
Doctor, oh, wow. Got a little Octaviate there. Dr. Otto Octavius, a.k.a. Doc Ock, Dr. Octopus.
My favorite. He became, this podcast made Dr. Otto Octavius my favorite, not only Spider-Man villain, but one of my favorite characters, just through the research and just seeing this guy just get kicked in the teeth just repeatedly over and over again.
It's little wonder he just became more and more villainous, because what is the term from Richard III to prove a villain?
Right. Right. You test the guy. All the guy wants to do is be the smartest guy in the room, and you just keep going. You can't just be like, sure, Otto, you're the smartest guy. Go... That means you get to pick up Jimmy Johns for the office today.
Yeah, that's right.
No, you don't get that.
No, and the thing about it is that it does sort of occur to me just now that Dr. Octopus is sort of the Richard III of comics.
That's deep.
He's not pretty. He's not fit. He's not anything. All he has is a very sharp mind. He's sort of the, an even more bitter Tyrion Lannister.
Oh, I was going to go with what was the guy's name? The eunuch. The manipulator. I can't remember his name, but we were both on a Game of Thrones page there, at least. So.
Oh yeah, it's like what was his name? Viserys. Yeah, I know where you're headed, though, but suddenly it's been, like, what, 3.5 years since the last one?
Right? I need to watch some of that. God, I don't even want to talk about the last issue. The last issue, we got real intimate with the Rhino. Various...
We went nuts with the Rhino, the Lizard. Yeah, we did get incredibly intimate with the Rhino.
We got real close.
Somehow I managed to expunge that from my thoughts. Now
it's
back.
Oh, I'm bringing it back. Oh, yeah. How do you put on an orca?
One leg at a time.
One leg at a time.
But we had the Lizard, the Vulture, the Scorpion.
Yeah,
pretty much everybody we could think of that was animal based. Even the kangaroo and the gibbon got coverage.
We were going for the cheap seats.
The beetle, which we had to remind was actually a type of animal.
It fits somewhere in there, yeah. But and then tonight I could not be more excited. Tonight we have tales of treachery, tales of conspiracy and villainy. And
intrigues,
irresponsibility, But overall, this is a tale not only of redemption, but of a one man's burning desire to see right done by any means necessary by his definitions.
Yes, if nothing else, we have a Spider-Man character, a Spider-Man villain, as you'll discover if you weren't around 2.5 years ago and don't want to go back through the back issue bins and find this. That, much to even my own surprise in making this realization, is this terrible, terrible type of villain. In fact, kind of the worst kind of villain, because he's able to operate in plain sight.
Well, yeah. Not only that, but he's the villain. He's you can point to his villainy and say, look, it's a villain. But there's absolutely nothing you can do about it. There's you can do about it. Tonight, we bring to you the tale of Spider-Man's greatest foe from 1963 until 2018. Cole, who do we talk about tonight?
Tonight, we're talking about the Triple J, the triple threat that is Triple J, none other than J. Jonah Jameson. And yes, you heard that right. Editor-in-Chief of the Daily Bugle for 100 years, J. Jonah Jameson.
100 years. But wait, Cole. J. Jonah Jameson is a fine-up member, outstanding member of New York society. How could he possibly be Spider-Man's greatest villain?
How can the editor-in-chief, the figurehead of a great metropolitan newspaper like New York's picture newspaper,
the Daily Bugle...
Hey, because we don't trust you to be able to read. We're New York's picture newspaper.
That should tell you everything you need to know about Jameson right there. You're too dumb to figure this out.
It's like, well, we're dealing with the lowest common denominator here. Now get out of here. Get me some news.
Give me some pictures of Spider-Man.
That's right. I'm figuring Spider-Man doing evil things. I want him in a green suit stealing from little old ladies, because that's obviously Spider-Man. He just changes colors.
That's right.
God's truth.
Before we get into this, my favorite Jameson story, and this is legitimately something that happened in the comic, was when he spotted a spider in his office and he was claiming that it was Spider-Man using like Ant-Man powers to infiltrate his, he had gotten to that point of paranoia at one point. I forget whether there was like drugs involved. Yeah, it was good stuff.
Tonight on a very special Spider-Man. But
I just had the Family Ties scene kicking in my brain. What would we do, baby? Yeah, like, we're a little punchy. Sorry, guys.
You take the good, you take the bad, you take them both, and there you have. Okay. shut up. What do you want to raise?
The facts of life are all about you, J. Jonah.
Yeah, the insidious thing about J. Jonah Jameson is that he's perhaps one of the best Spider-Man villains, because I think by and large he was written in such a way that most writers probably didn't realize that, especially as his anti-Spider-Man hyperbole grows and festers in his mind and becomes the most all-consuming part of his life, he becomes this, you know, Spider-Man is the great white whale, or the great red spider webby whale. He becomes this Ahab, he can see. And in many ways, the entire Moby Dick analog is very appropriate. Mainly because we get the chance to say Dick and
a lot.
It for once, yeah, not be a Dick joke. It's a Moby Dick joke. And but also
Moby's
because
Dick joke.
That's right. But Herman Melville sure can write. But
a Dick joke. What if that was the end of the entire book? What if that was the end of the entire book? Ended up being a dick joke. It was how many pages?
The original working title was Ishmael's Dick Joke.
You can call it Ishmael. That was the title.
So then the editors got involved, and that last little bit of the final chapter was excised. But
speaking of editors.
But the thing about it is, if you look at the Daily Bugle as a ship and J. Jonah Jameson as his obsessed captain, he's constantly threatening to run this thing aground of yellow journalism as his obsession with Spider-Man grows and grows. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, if you're having trouble getting your head around Jameson as a villain, yeah, sure, he blasts Spider-Man. Sure, he is the, you know, the monger of Spidey fake news and trying his dead level best to turn a city that loves Spider-Man against him. And being the newspaper a lot of our parents would read.
Wow. Topical.
Yes, indeed. You also have to look at the fact that historically, yes, not once, not twice, not even just a mere three times, this is bordering on dangerous obsession, J. Jonah Jameson is funneling his personal and perhaps even corporate resources into what is effectively attempted murder.
Oh, it's absolutely attempted murder. He creates an assassin to kill Spider-Man.
Yes. I mean, this is like, talking about wagging the dog. I just,
that's
you
like,
can't
I
turn the city against Spider-Man. Just kill the dude.
I forget whose joke it is, but that's like the joke. He's choking his way up to the front row of the Eyes Wide Shut party. There, that's a different kind. Now, so to really explain how, because if you look at it now in the parlance of our time. In the parlance of where we are,
yes,
it doesn't make a lot of sense for Jameson to have, and in recent years, they've relaxed some of Jameson's, let's just call it political power, in recent years. But coming into this, it doesn't make a lot of sense for Jameson to have the power that he does unless you have some context based around that power. The first thing that we need to talk about, Cole, is and this gets a little history. This gets a little history.
Yeah.
And I think that we were talking off mic that I was it Catherine that had the idea to do the entire episode on newspapers?
Yes, indeed. When we were talking about this, and I was speaking toward a future issue of the show about Perry White. Even though we're talking about Jameson very heavily in this one, I think that Catherine's idea of doing an episode titled The Fifth Estate that's where we need to be heading, because we can talk about Perry White and we can talk about J. Jonah Jameson and we can talk about newspaper as an entity within comics, because I think because of the Daily Planet, you got to the point where the newspaper man is an important character in comics, to the point that it is literally a journalist who is the focal point of one of the best comic series ever created, which was Marvel's.
Oh, you're right.
Because it uses a newspaper man. But that is a story for another day. And
it is.
We'll save that for question.
I do want to dig into a little bit of that context, just to give everybody a little bit of an idea of how Jameson came to be and what was represented there. And so let's take it to the Wayback Machine. Now the lens of the camera turns to the 1920s. Old Hollywood.
Yeah. Well, Shaman, we're now in 1920s America. Well, gosh, Mr. Peabody, it was sure effed up.
The first thing I want to talk about is consolidation. So, shockingly, a lot of what we're going to talk about tonight is a mirror image of what we are going through now. Nobody's surprised. So, consolidation between 45 and 65, there were 1,500 daily newspapers in cities. So you would have your, you know, wherever I am, Daily Sun, and you would have wherever Cole is, you know, Tribune, by that was down to 368. It's down to 421 closed and wrenched and consolidated under these kind of two banners. These two banners, one being a name that you'll be very familiar with, and I don't know if you know that this is where the name came from. The last name Pulitzer, Joseph Pulitzer.
Ah, yes.
And William Randolph Hearst. And thus, the what became known as and continues to be known as yellow journalism comes into play, Cole.
Absolutely. And this is, if you're unfamiliar, precisely the sort of journalism plied by Jameson, where you're using the influence and the power of this print media, and it's in many ways, as far back as the 20s, you're beginning to see the inklings of what I personally call the "because I said so" phenomenon.
Okay.
We're unfortunately becoming a society where because someone says something, even if it's false or inaccurate, the reality presented in stark contrast is not enough to undo what the first thing people hear or the first thing people see. And I think we're seeing an increase. It's an exponent, on an exponential level of what begins with the newspaper.
Yeah. Yes. And keep in mind, there was no internet. There was some radio, and as time went on, there was more radio. But there was no internet to fall back on. There was the newspaper. That's what you had. That's where you got your news. If you read it in the newspaper, it was gospel. So you had these two guys that had consolidated all of this power going to war with each other for sales, the bottom line. So you had this escalating war of blood and guts and if it bleeds, it leads. And these guys, Hearst and Pulitzer, as time went on, just had amassed enormous power.
Absolutely. In addition to enormous fortunes, they began to become sort of the voice of everything. They were your source. One or the other's dailies. And you have to put a little context on this. Today we see daily newspapers, and oftentimes you're rather surprised you can still get an analog print version of anything.
Right.
But to also give a little context, you're talking about a period where there were a minimum in a major market for the big players would have a minimum of two prints a day.
That's true. That is absolutely
It was not
true.
Uncommon for dad to read the morning papers and arrive from the factory or from the office and take on the evening paper.
There was no
because
there were daily
you did night not paper. Have that. Yeah, that was your 20. That was your 19-hour news cycle. back in the day.
It's the 19-hour, and that was too much. We're being inundated. 19 hours.
That was this is also a period in American history where mail was delivered twice a day and on Sunday. Lucky bastards.
How much was bread, Cole?
when I was a child.
We're old.
The breadmobile would just drive down the street and loaves would fall off in your front yard.
It had a spring loaded, ba-doing, and the bread would just land on your porch.
It was kind of like one of those baseball pitching machines.
But in this period of power consolidation, in this period of yellow journalism, in this period of print anything you can to sell, does it need to be newsworthy? Not necessarily.
Yeah.
You get lines like my favorite is. And I actually threw this into the notes at the top. You furnish the pictures, I'll furnish the war, which was William Randolph Hearst's famous quote. You get the idea of a J. Jonah Jameson. You get the idea of...
That was a brilliant find as well, because that immediately invoked, that's why I mentioned the New York's picture newspaper, if you give me anything, we'll build a story around it.
Right.
And in many ways, nowadays you see a lot of people bemoan what are called the clickbait headlines. And nowadays, almost everything's a clickbait headline. I remember actually, in kind of an aside here, seeing a headline like, okay, I'll bite. It was something about Bob Dylan being frog marched off the beach in some resort town. And it turned, I had to actually look up frog march because I had not heard that term. And, you know, the definition of how he was escorted off of a beach because he was mistaken for a homeless person, not at all surprisingly, and how the whole thing got cleared up within minutes of arriving at the station and being recognized and him having some jovial fun with the officers and then being returned to his home. Nothing in that was like some belligerent protester had. Because they're, you know, won't even stand on their own. And it was just like, okay, do you even know what that term means? I mean, I had to look it up, but you should have as well, because he wasn't frog marched off the beach. He was just simply asked to come with these officers, which he did. And in the body of the story, it's like, okay. But the thing about it is, it occurred to me that this was the sort of thing that was going on in newspapers for centuries.
Oh, very much so. Yes, yes.
It was almost like, you know, to coin a phrase, it was, you know, the clinking of the coins that you're dropping down to the news vendor. It was sort of like clinkbait headlines.
Ah, clinkbaits. I like it. So, yeah, J. Jonah Jameson, spun out of all of this, was built around this idea. This is why you have so many newspapers in the 50s and 60s.
Okay, I think you're back. So it becomes a situation where it's all about the sales. It doesn't really matter. And I think there was less and less oversight on anyone's part. There wasn't a whole world of other outlets saying, au contraire, nobody was publishing a rag that said, you know, fact-checking Hearst's latest giant headlines.
Well, I think that, you know, as we start getting into, like, Jameson and what he did and how he was a man of principle. He was a man of conviction. He believed that Spider-Man was a menace. He believes it in his heart of hearts. But he was given the ultimate weapon to wage a war against an innocent to point a loaded media gun at this kid. And fire away at him, using the tactics that have been established before he got there.
Well, in fact, a few days ago, we were discussing this very episode. We've been chomping the bit to get to Jameson in this particular context. And one of the things that occurred to me was how wonderfully amazing it was. Jameson becomes a character in Spider-Man where, you know, speaking of having your mind blown, when you find out that the concept, the phrase of "with great power comes great responsibility," that was Stan Lee's.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was something that kind of got folded into Spider-Man that was handed down to us from the Antediluvian or something. But no, it was actually Stan Lee, who has no idea where that came from. It just sort of popped in his head, and it worked well. But what's interesting is in the same titles or, you know, the related titles, the Spider-Man portion of the Marvel Universe pie, within that realm, you not only have Uncle Ben imparting to Peter that with great power comes great responsibility, you also have a character who is the antithesis of this.
Yes.
The character with ultimate power and taking zero responsibility is just using the Daily Planet as this great cudgel to just stamp out anything he doesn't agree with.
Well, and that's interesting, you know, because of the fact that you know, we look at this character and we say, okay, we need a Joker for the Spider-Man, you know, for Spider-Man's Batman. So what is the Joker to Batman? He is the antithesis. He is the opposite. He is, you know, the uncovering of Spider-Man's identity, which is his driving force. And most recently, we found out why, has been his make Batman laugh t- type, you know, his modus operandi. So, you know, this whole thing is just to uncover the identity of Spider-Man. And it has to be, you know, using Peter Parker. And that's a slap in the face. Okay, so there's a lot of metaphor with this character. And one of the biggest ones is, yes, you are all powerful. Yes, you are an American hero with a son that's an astronaut. So you are given a certain weight and credibility from that. Yes, you have all of these quivers in your arrow. Arrows in your quiver, not the other way around. That doesn't work.
That was a bizarre analog there.
It was. But
that was like a yellow submarine hole in my pocket.
But you keep hiring the guy that is Spider-Man to take pictures of Spider-Man and paying him, which is, I think, a direct metaphor for society looking back at power and saying, we see what you're doing. You know,
exactly.
We don't buy it.
And I think also the fact that, you know, what's interesting is that Peter Parker uses Spider-Man to feed Jameson's obsession and also feed himself, in the sense that,
literally,
you know, he's the one guy who gets the best pictures of Spider-Man. And it's the one thing that Jameson craves. And he's literally pitting his own enemy against himself by, you know, basically finding gainful employment in the environs of the very man that's against his alter ego.
It's fantastic. It's.
I mean, what a wonderful slap in the face. Like, it's like Peter's almost saying, you know, JJJ, if you ever find out who I am or who Spider-Man is, it is going to be the most tremendous. It's like the egg truck just tipped over on your face.
Right, right. And that's
it's going
awesome.
To be egg on every part of you, because that is
you're gonna be in a bath, an egg wash.
Egg bath, that's right.
That's awesome. But speaking of Stan Lee, in the research for doing this, Cole and I uncovered what might be, and I lost my mind.
I would have to give credit where it's due. You found this and You write to me, like, I am totally blown away, and then you tell me, and I'm like, dear Lord, that it's so – there are things that when they're presented to you I coined the term right there on the spot that we'd been Martha'd.
Yes. That is the best thing to come out of this issue is the term Martha'd.
To discover – which is to – basically have something pointed out to you that was right in front of you all the time and you never noticed, because why would you?
Right.
And in this case, it's – we've been Martha'd in that, like, just, you know, having the otherwise forgettable Batman v Superman, at least in my opinion, the one takeaway from that was like, damn it, why did it never occur to me that both of their – maternal figures had the same name. Never noticed.
No.
I had to have it just shoved in my face to realize that was there all the time. And that's essentially what happens here is, Andy, you're looking around, finding some things about Jameson, doing your intense research, your Daily Bugle investigative journalism level search for information on characters.
Yes.
And then you find a bombshell.
I find a bombshell, and the reason that I said at the top of the show conspiracy is because it's never been corroborated. Okay? It has walked into corroboration's house uninvited. Let's put it that way. It has been all but said, yes, I absolutely did that on purpose. Speaking of Stan Lee. So Jameson was introduced 1960s as a newspaper publisher that decided that Spider-Man was the greatest menace in New York, if not all of America. And the reason that he wanted this menace to be taken in and have the the hood pulled off his face and everybody to see who he was and shut him down and get him off the streets was because he was afraid that other teenagers and children would attempt to emulate Spider-Man and get hurt.
Yeah.
This is the reason this has started J. Jonah Jameson's terror campaign for the last 80 years against Spider-Man. That was it. That was your reason. 1963. What else happened right around that time? The mid-50s to early 60s, Cole?
Well, see, and this is where part of the irony comes in, because in the very earliest issues of this very show...
It's in the title of our show. It's in Eddie's read for our intro.
Yes, indeed. We talked about the very thing that becomes the most brilliant analog here, and that is Wortham's Seduction of the Innocent and the kind of this impassioned campaign against a perceived evil by someone in a position of authority that goes unquestioned.
Right.
And it was Wortham's Seduction of the Innocent that threatened to topple an industry. It destroyed a lot of genre that were arguably just pointless sensationalism anyway, being things like the EC horror comics where, you know, graphic violence that it was sort of like, you know, if you look at movies like Saw or Hostel, we've been doing this for centuries. You know, you go back to the 50s with the EC comics, they were your Saw and Hostel of their day. But you can go back to like the 19th century France, and I think we may have talked about this before on the show, to the Grand Guignol Theater.
We have talked about it, yes.
Where, yes, it was just like this was graphic violence and gore on the stage. You know, probably three or four times a week plus Sunday matinees.
That's right. Bring Grandma.
Yeah, and you know, and some of the titles were just sort of like, you know, the came just shy of, you know, tonight we're presenting the our latest production, brutal mass murder and beheading and torture of 26 characters you don't care about because they're all going to die.
That's right. So keep in mind, the word menace. The Wortham used to tour on a lecture series called Comic Books, The Menace to American Childhood. if you know anything about J. Jonah Jameson, he woke up in the night screaming the word menace. He used to order menace with his steak fries. Like, that was right. His thing. So,
oh, yeah, I mean, the Daily Bugle in their daily funnies would not run Dennis the Menace.
So,
because they already had a Menace.
They just called it Dennis.
Yeah, yeah, it was run simply as Dennis.
So Stanley wrote J. Jonah Jameson as a direct analog to both, okay? To both the power and the corruption in media, print media at the time, and a direct slap in the face to Wortham and the Seduction of the Innocent, and the ensuing Comics Code of Authority that Stan Lee was directly involved with as one of the major comic creators of the time.
Yes, I mean, it was sort of like the rest of the comics industry forced to become part of this self-policing entity or face, you know, the consequences of paranoia that was being, you know, foisted upon the nation, as it were, because a hack psychologist imagined there was a simple equation to understand the direct line between juvenile delinquency and juvenile crime. He had to find a singular answer, and very often that's one of the great human fallacies, is trying to find taking unquantifiable abstracts and forcing them into a a mold that then we can point to and say, well, here's your simple answer.
So you're talking about violent video games, right?
Or the Three Stooges, or violent
rap
movies,
music?
All of them are threats or nemesis, depending on who you ask. Yes, indeed. In fact, good night. Probably 25 years ago or more, I was invited to lecture.
That Eyes Wide Shut party? Tell me it was that Eyes Wide Shut party.
I wish. I was invited to lecture to a class on ethics and journalism, which was also, had the or, and then in parentheses, oxymoron 101.
Right.
And
keep walking.
I knew enough about it. Was a professor that Catherine had taken classes under, and I knew enough to actually be a little forewarned about. He was sort of waiting in the wings, and I was talking about the nature of violence as portrayed in media, and it's that very thing of is this the core, is this the catalyst? And of course it's not. It is a handful of individuals who latch on to the certain things. And he was the professor for this class was very, trying to trip me up a little bit by, presenting some scenarios. And I basically turned and said, I've got two brothers. We grew up watching the Three Stooges, and we'd never put each other's heads in letter presses. And the entire class just exploded in applause.
Right. Have you met my friend Strawman?
Yes, exactly. And I think it was that. This was at a time where that was yet again rearing its head. The whole Dungeons & Dragons controversy had died out, so then it was something else. And this was also the period where you saw the rise of the yellow journalistic talk shows.
Yes. Which Jameson had, by the way. He's been – they reinvented him at every step to represent that that macro, right? So they would use him as a micro to represent whatever macro. So print media, TV, and now into blogging and internet clickbait stories now.
ThreadRevenge.com.
I think you're right. I don't actually think you're wrong, Cole. I think you pretty much hit it.
If there was a shrewd writer heading in that direction, why wouldn't you call Jameson's blog ThreadRevenge.com after all these years?
Right. Okay, so now we've established Jameson. We've established how he has his power, why he has his power historically, and we've kind of said this is why he was created. This is why he is the man that he is.
Well, in many ways, Jameson becomes representative of Wortham and the anti-comic hysteria. And this sort of idea that if you say something is the reason everything's wrong, then you have a target that people can rally, they can rail against.
Correct.
And as comic books were to Wortham, Spider-Man is to Jameson. And in many ways, it is such a particularly obvious connection between the two that escapes us for decades until somebody points this out, and you begin to realize exactly how much, in many ways, whether intentionally or just by pure chance, Jameson becomes that sort of, we need to find something to point out. There are things we're angry about. There are things we're scared of. We need to end like Shyamalan's village things.
Well, what was
we need
it
our
that,
boogeyman.
What was it that Tommy Lee Jones said in Under Siege? The thing about a revolution is it always comes back around to smack you in the face. Is that what he said? I think
something like that.
Yeah. So, but much like Wortham and Congress, because we talked about how he actually went before Congress and testified and tried to build this case and build an army around the idea that these comic books were evil and we needed to stop them. Jameson built himself a little bit of an army too, didn't he, Cole?
He did indeed. But he couldn't turn public opinion against Spider-Man, because as he's trying to espouse this menace, to present his straw man in a crimson and navy web suit, the very target of his journalistic tirades is constantly going out and like rescuing children from fires or, smacking down some supervillain or saving the day here and there, or, you know, in stark defiance of, in spite of the potential for being arrested.
Right.
Because he was operating in a world chock full of vigilantism, but he was the scapegoat. He was the one who had to be up to no good. Yet, especially New Yorkers couldn't walk out the door without, they had to mind their feet for fear of stepping on somebody's cape.
Yes, that's true. That's true. You went into the bodega and you had to get behind the prowler and
you never knew who you were going to encounter next, and it was just almost like a casual nod to one another if you passed a superhuman being. He's like, "Hey, Fred, hey."
The Jeep wave that you see.
The pistol wink, what have you. But,
that's what I want to see everywhere in these movies now that we've built a universe. The wink and the nod. All right, bang, bang. Yeah.
That's right. Hey, two guns.
No, literally, that's Two Gun Kid. Just be careful. Yeah. He's got two guns.
Yeah, be careful. He's got two actual guns. You really don't want to do that maneuver with him. Maybe just kind of a casual sideways wave would be more appropriate.
Yeah. Don't look Two Gun Kid in the eyes. He views it as a
I'm starting to see these scenarios that you would often see a lot of unnecessary deaths in Muggerville for that very reason.
Very much so. Three Gun Kid. I don't know why he has the third one. But
it's backup.
Oh, okay, because the other one's jammed.
Well, his tagline was 18 shots are better than 12.
That's a good tagline. It's also a long tagline, which fits for Muggerville. Like
you have to understand Muggerville is a city that's famous for like having a zoo that in their collection has a puma, a cougar, and a mountain lion.
Wow. Good job. Good job. They have a lynx, a bobcat.
That's right. So, I don't even know where we're headed with it. Oh, but the thing about it is you have, like, the Fantastic Four, the first family of superheroes operating in full public view. You have the Avengers out fighting crime on every level, and then you get like the street level guy trying to help out, and he's the bad guy. And I think that that's where most of New York is kind of coming in behind him. It's like the scene in Spider-Man 2 where they're like, "Yeah, sure thing, Doc Ock. I tell you what, we like Spider-Man, and so." Go to hell. And
stop pushing it, man. Stop pushing it.
And it becomes this sort of thing where there's this escalation.
Oh, yeah.
Because he can't harpoon his white whale. He has to go out and, like, bring in an armada. It would be like if, Ahab had the ability to call in the Navy. And I want 20 cannon on this whale. It's a giant sea mammal, sir. You can't, like... You can't go amidships and fire into it. We can't broadside a whale.
I mean, you could, I suppose.
If you want to waste a lot of cannon shot, sure, we'll just, it'll be a bit of a mess there, but whatever you want.
But also keep in mind, let's get to the meat and potatoes of...
At some point, Jameson snaps to a level to which not only does he conceive of and find the resources and the materials and the technology, he finds someone who actually is more than willing to build a robotic spider slayer. I mean, on the blueprint, it's written out in blue and more blue, Spider Slayer. There is no question. If this ever went to court, it would be like the easiest case for, you know, the Law and Order guys. It's like, really, we have nothing to, not even pointing to bring anything up. It's all right there in the evidence.
If I was a, let's say I was a massive, like, cocaine dealer, like, let's say a Pablo Escobar, say I was a true drug lord, you know what I would do with all those bags? I would get my face printed on all of them so that everybody would know I was involved.
You would have your name and address, like, it had, like, these labels made up, because that's essentially, yeah, that's a great analog here, a great way to present this, because essentially what Jameson becomes is like you say, like Pablo Escobar. If you had every single bag of cocaine have a big, you know, specially printed label on it, you know, it's coming off the line. They got to put that label on there that says, you know, Pablo Escobar Incorporated with the corporate address and, you know, facility tours available for classrooms.
So this guy, Spencer Smythe, makes the first round of these Spider Slayers that Jameson commissions. He dies. He dies because Spider-Man breaks out of one of the, like the casing or the shell of the power, you know, the radioactive power cell that runs him, and he gets radioactive poisoning and dies. So Jameson has him make these things. He sends them after Spider-Man to kill Spider-Man. Spider-Man stops them from killing him, and in doing so, basically accidentally cracks one open. The guy that made them dies. So his son, Alistair Smythe, says...
New Smythe.
Yeah. Ooh, I'm going to get you, Spider-Man, for killing my dad. Not, wait, maybe I should blame Jameson for this.
Yeah, you know, my dad died in the commission of a major capital crime.
Right.
But he died because of Spider-Man, and obviously, Smythe was a very avid reader of the Daily Planet.
Yeah, he bought in.
Yeah, and the thing about it is, even if you didn't know Jameson was directly involved, almost this just hypothyroid hubris at work. Jameson, and this is where the whole, you know, Pablo Escobar Incorporated, please drop by and arrest me, comes into play. At least two, if not more, of the Spider Slayers, which came in all kinds of shapes and sizes and had weird different ways of and it was almost like Stop That Pigeon. They're like sitting back at the lab coming up with ridiculous new ways to kill Spider-Man.
Right, right. It's like the writer's room at The Onion.
Exactly. And it's like, okay, the wall crawling robot didn't work. Let's make a robot that looks like a spider. That didn't work. How about we do another one that has all these weird polymetic polyalloy tendrils, and none of them seem to work. So it's just like constantly back to the drawing board.
You,
it's like,
you know how
Wile E. Coyote thought that the Smythes were obsessive.
You know how seriously everybody takes Artem Zola, right? Let's just do that about seven times. That'll work.
And Artem Zola is a good example, because at least two, if not three, of the Spider Slayers featured closed circuit television with a close-up of J. Jonah Jameson menacing Spider-Man in real time.
Yes! Like, I'm watching you, but I'm not just watching you. My face is watching you. Watch my face watch you. I want to watch you die, but I can only do it with my entire face.
That's right. Here, I'm going to put my stamp of approval on murder of a superhuman in New York City that is beloved by the city. I'm going to put my face front and center. In fact, one of them actually had JJJ embossed into the chest plate of the robot.
It was his desk placard.
Yeah.
He's lifted up and glued it right to the front of the robot.
That's right. Because here we go. Now we're done. Get out there and do some killing.
Yeah, but that's not, I mean, even that's not as insidious as trying to turn a public against someone. And then.
No, but then to have, it's just the unmitigated impunity with which he is publicly willing to show his face as the face of a would-be murderer. It would be like if, you know, William Randolph Hearst wanted to have someone killed by a contract killer and put it on the front page. I just hired the best assassin in the nation to kill this guy. And then the guy's like, the hell? And then he's shot.
Oh, you mean like saying that J. Jonah Jameson could shoot somebody on Pennsylvania Avenue and still get elected? And then get elected?
Oh, I say nothing.
Topical.
Exactly.
I'm just saying, right. there are a lot of touchstones to this story that...
I mean, a lot of people don't remember that one storyline in Spider-Man, which was Frost Jameson.
That was good. That was a good joke. I like that. I wish I could think of another journalist in Marvel that I could use, like Jessica Jones Jameson, Jones Jameson.
An editor of the Daily Planet does something that isn't illegal.
That's right. I can pardon myself to the shareholders. No, but and the sad thing is, so much like the industrial military complex, right? Beware the industrial military complex. You now have an army of super robots out there, hell-bent on destroying, first of all, Spider-Man, second of all, whoever they can reprogram to kill, that are no longer under your control.
Yes.
But you've made them, and they just keep coming. They're out there. Smythe ain't going to stop. The Goblin King ain't going to stop, because the other part of it is once – oh, yeah, by the way, we haven't even touched on the fact that J. Jonah Jameson was elected mayor of New York.
Oh, my.
So he's finished.
Yeah, so he literally could at least attempt to kill Spider-Man and get elected mayor.
Well, he created an army of basically what does he call it? Crap, I can't remember what he calls it. Like a task force using like old Mandroid armor and spider slayers to go after Spider-Man. Super Slayer or Spider Slayer. Hold on. I'm going back to one. Let me roll that back. Spider Slayer Squad to go after Spider-Man. He just keeps sending them after him. This guy can't let it go. Queequeg.
Yeah.
His dog was named Queequeg.
He'd already invested so much in them anyways.
That's true. They were already out there. You might as well use them, right? I already bought this six-pack. I know I was just going to drink one, but there's five just sitting there. Yeah, so...
I can quit trying to kill Spider-Man anytime I want.
That's good. So let's move up to modern times. We're kind of running low on time, so let's jump up to a little more recent times. There was a recent story. This is the story of how J. Jonah Jameson learns the secret identity of Spider-Man, which happens fairly recently. So Jameson has fallen, and you and I had talked about this months ago. Jameson fell on hard times. He, you know, was no longer with the Bugle because times, they're changing. Bob Dylan, Frog Marched Off a Beach.
great recall.
Oh, yeah, I've got like 40-minute recall. Don't ask me for anything longer than that. All of this stuff has happened to Jameson. He's kind of relegated to, like we were talking about earlier, create his own blog. So Chip Zdarsky writes the new Spectacular Spider-Man book. It's fantastic. If you haven't read it, you absolutely need to. And in it, in number, I believe, six, it is in six, Spider-Man needs something from Jameson. So he sits down and says, you have 1 hour. Ask me whatever you want. I give you an interview. I sit across from you at your kitchen table for 1 hour. So he sits down and goes through, you know, and Jameson's asking him, you know, all these questions, and you know, they're bantering back and forth. And it comes out that Jameson is so angry with Spider-Man and wants Spider-Man's identity revealed so badly because it represents a mugging that he went through when he was younger and they wore a mask and his wife was shot and, you know, all of these things had happened and he decides, you know, and he has nothing to live for anymore. And he has a breakdown. He has a breakdown, and it's not, you know, when you want to raise Jameson. It's not Spider-Man is a man in screaming pictures. It's a full-on breakdown because he lost his wife to a spider slayer that he helped create. Hubris!
Wow, yeah.
You know, his life has been ruined because the industry that he loves has changed so much that he can't keep up with it, and he still, to this day, has not been able to figure out Spider-Man's identity. Like, so he's having a complete breakdown, and Spider-Man at that point pulls off his mask and says, you know, this is me, you know, we're in this together now. And from that point on in the comic books, it becomes a Riggs and Murtaugh buddy, oddly buddy cop thing because of the fact that Jameson's dad had married Aunt May. So they were stepbrothers and Jameson did not know it. So all of a sudden, Jameson can't do anything with that information. It was like, who are we talking about? It was Green Goblin. It's the reverse of the Green Goblin. Jameson can't do anything with that information because if he outs Peter Parker as Spider-Man,
he puts his own father at risk.
And his new mother.
Yeah, and his new stepmother. And he, you know, becomes as responsible. It basically becomes that same burden all over again where he was partially responsible for the death of his wife. He certainly can't knowingly, willingly be complicit in the endangerment of his own parents, as it were.
Yeah.
And, you know, the man has had a curiously difficult life from having to stare down the cold truth that in creating the Spider Slayers, he's also complicit in, I believe I read somewhere that he was partially or at least if not fully responsible for the creation of the Scorpion.
He was, yes.
He was certainly responsible for a lot of other people joining the Let's Kill Spider-Man bandwagon.
Oh, absolutely.
including Smythe the Younger. And that one's for Kelly. But, you know, you have this character who's, you know, at every turn, his celebrated son turns into a space werewolf.
We didn't even get into that.
No wonder the guy's a little messed up.
Yeah.
But it's one of those characters that I think it part of the reason we went this route, because we could have mixed this up in a lot of different ways. There's so many Spider-Man villains that got no coverage at all. Or, you know, that we glossed over to do the Animal Kingdom episode. But it was important to really explore this realization that he's not just a foil.
No.
Jameson is an example of the excesses of those in power. And utilizing that power, that bully pulpit, in the worst possible ways. And, you know, there are notes that ring true from the 60s straight through to today.
Yeah, absolutely.
And this is the face of true evil. It becomes sort of like the
Kaiser Soze.
Yes, because it's evil hiding in plain sight.
Well, you don't want to. You know Spider-Man's identity. You don't want to run him to ground any less than you already do. But now you can't. Yeah. Like that's that's I keep telling you about my favorite thing that from the new Spider-Man with where Jameson knows his identity, and I think it rings truer at the end of this episode than it did at the beginning, is Spider-Man is being hunted by S.H.I.E.L.D. essentially for reasons that I do not have time to get into, and he's in a he's in a burning building and he's trying to get these kids out, and S.H.I.E.L.D. has infiltrated the building and they're coming after him, and he makes it out of the building and walks outside, and he's still in Spider-Man regalia, but he kind of ducks out the side door, and a car pulls up and a door whips open and it's Jameson. He's like, get in! and Spider-Man jumps in, and keep in mind, this is after the events of Spider-Man Amazing, Spectacular Spider-Man 6, and he's like, how did you know where to find me? And he's like, he basically says, Parker, I've been in this industry for 60 years. You don't think I've developed a set of skills by then? I'm a reporter at heart. And I think that's the important thing to remember is, regardless of all of this, him being Spider-Man's greatest villain, him being Spider-Man's Joker, him attempted murdering Spider-Man.
Repeatedly. He's like a serial attempted murderer.
He's the worst murderer ever. He still thinks and has developed the skill set to be an honest news gathering and reporting editor. And I think that's him. And I'm curious to see where they go with it now that he has the information that he has. Because he has to keep that air, right?
In fact, that's one of the things I was thinking is I would love to see how they approach him. He can't simply one day say, well, I decided Spider-Man's not so bad after all.
Right, right.
Like, what? What happened? It's just like when, when Larry Flint turned to God, or what's going on here? you don't see this sort of overnight thing happening with moguls in any industry.
Yes. So I'm curious to see what happens. Do you have any final wrap-up thoughts for the entire story arc?
Oh, I think this was really satisfying because we had done Roguish Eyes so many months ago, and it was such a fun approach to giving in-depth looks at different villains. And it occurred to me, as I was – I often say that this is true. I checked the other day. This show is plotted through April of 2020.
That's crazy.
And will very likely be plotted through July or August 2020 at the rate things are going.
Right.
Because there are constantly new things that are far too topical to wait that come in. It is evidenced by any time we do a movie or TV related show or something that is like going on right now in comics that we feel we really have to talk about, and things get pushed back.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, we can do this issue, 37 issues from now instead of 35. So, or the realization as I'm looking down the list, I like, oh, guess what? I forgot to include the Christmas episode in December of this particular year, and that bumps everybody. And it was looking over the some of the past issues and looking at the Roguish Eyes and realizing, that applies to so many characters. Who do we need to explore? And, of course, Spider-Man has that kind of Batman-level rogues gallery.
Yeah.
That there's far too many characters to talk about, and there's so many fascinating tales. And I think my takeaway from this arc is that I didn't realize when we started precisely how fascinating a lot of these characters would turn out to be.
Yeah, absolutely accurate. Like, this has been the next to the Batman, because I've noticed it's something that's differential between DC and DC and Batman. What the hell? It's been a long run. DC and Marvel. With Marvel, you get this kind of what our show is based on, which is in specific general themes that play into the characters, right? So, like today, we talked about yellow journalism and the consolidation wars and newspapers. And for Green Goblin, we talked about Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. But with DC, it was very much, I want to say Adrian Veidt, but that's not right. That's a different guy. It was very much point by point by point this is who influenced the creation of this, this, and this. So Marvel was really interesting. It was probably the most fun I've had doing research yet.
Absolutely, because it, and that's, you know, in looking at, as we're looking back 270 prior issues of the show, plus specials and other things, and the hundreds and hundreds of hours of programming that we produce on this show alone, I've said it many times that what this show has done for me, and we hope that it does for our listeners, is to get you thinking about comics
right.
in new ways, because there is so much subtext that a lot of times we get caught up in the best stories or the worst stories at times, and the best and worst characters, and so many aspects of the actual publications themselves that until you start to really sit down and analyze a lot of stuff, and of course, you know, we live in a world where everybody can, there are hundreds of blogs out there just picking apart these stories and discovering things that, you know, may not have even been intentional, but are still there. You can find these threads. And that's been, it's been an amazing journey this long, this many years, this many issues. I never imagined, you know, we would be pushing 300 issues in the next year. That just finding, the more you sound out some of your favorite characters, your favorite storylines, the more you discover that you never knew was there until you started talking about them out loud.
Agreed. Agreed. So what are we doing? What are we doing next, next week, buddy?
Well, next week we're going to have a little fun, kids, because we're going to have squee. We're going to talk about Deadpool and Deadpool 2.
Ooh.
And the journey there. We're going to talk about, on a personal level, we're going to be looking at a character that I couldn't have cared. I honestly could. I would have to force myself to care any less about.
Right.
Because it's just a, there was nothing for me to hang my hat on. I was familiar, aware. You couldn't help but be aware of the character of Deadpool. But I didn't care about this character.
No.
And then along comes Ryan Reynolds. This is the Deadpool we deserve. Real.
Yeah.
And like, I will go see this movie all day long. Forever. And they delivered the very movie. I honestly, I don't know that you could say that, you know, there's always somebody, the big going complaint right now, especially with, like, say, Star Wars films, where you have an established fan base, or comic book based movies, this isn't the movie I wanted, is a, you hear that drum beat.
Yes.
And I don't think anyone could say this isn't the movie I wanted when it comes to Deadpool. So we'll be with you next week with Reynolds Wrap, where we're going to rap about Ryan Reynolds and the journey to Deadpool. Deadpool itself, and just what an amazing, what you can achieve when, as far as I know, this had to have been a situation where the studio left their hands the hell off.
Oh, I believe so.
Because there are no notes of studio meddling that you can, that are just glaring in some films.
Correct. They also didn't have to replace the director, and you didn't get a giant space squid. Hashtag not the movie I wanted.
Hey.
I'm kidding.
Anytime, I'm not going to be invited on the solo episode.
As long as Donald Glover's working, I'm happy.
I'm with you there.
So why don't you plug us up and we'll get out of here. You've had a long weekend. Tell everybody what you did this weekend, Cole.
Oh, yes. In fact, this weekend I'm just not, at this point, not fresh off of a weekend, but fresh-ish off the weekend at the DFW G.I. Joe and Action Figure Show. This was their 7th year.
It's insane.
And it's been amazing to watch that show evolve and grow, and they're really achieving their goal of, you know, even though G.I. Joe is in the beginning of the title, people are realizing this is a great resource for finding action figures and toys of every kind. I found some great Marvel Universe characters and some other stuff, and I even bought a couple of toys for Isle of Toys basket that is the centerpiece of the show over on Dallas On Air. So that was a lot of fun. And for the first time ever, Dallas On Air was actually there with a booth, and we live streamed 7 shows over the course of the weekend that went out live on Dallas On Air. The Rancor Pit, Vagabond Nerds, Justice Sec, Figments, Next Issue, Isle of Toys. It was just amazing to have these things. You're sitting there realizing somebody could be tuning in right now, and I think someone did tune in. Andrew Farmer tuned into the Rancor Pit
as
we streamed live on a day we're not normally out there.
It's always interesting to me the ways that you can find the shows. You know, I hit it on Facebook. It's available on the website. You know, there's all kinds of ways that you can get in here and watch those live shows. And I think you've got another live show coming up next week, don't you, Cole?
Yes, indeed. On Sunday, the first Sunday of July, of June, not July, the June that July that comes before July, known as June. First Sunday of June, we have Isle of Toys. Isle 10 is coming up. What is on that aisle is a little bit up in the air, but I'm hoping to get a guy that I've seen at many of these G.I. Joe shows, who over the last few years has been selling off a collection of some of the most oddball toys you'd ever imagine.
That's awesome.
And I would love to talk about some of the, you know, like at the show this weekend, he had the Love Boat action figures.
Nuh-uh!
And that actually came up on Justice Act when we were streaming live on that. I was guesting on that show. And that's pretty much what Danny Gallagher said.
There's no way. That's amazing. That's amazing. Oh,
that's just the tip of the iceberg that sank the Pacific Princess. Wow, that worked out real well.
This is good. That was good transition.
So, yeah, check us out, DallasOnAir.com, on Sunday from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Central at the Isle of Toys, followed immediately by the latest episode of the Rancor Pit Live. It's just been amazing. 4 years of the Rancor Pit Live. Are you kidding me?
4 years,
and,
man.
And 5 years of the original recorded show is back on the Jedi Cult Universe. We've done a couple of episodes back to back now. We're getting ready to do another one here in the next few days. So if you've missed out, the latest episode was when Lucas got hammered, where we talked about the Hammer horror film connection with Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee. And of course, you can find us here at the Jedi Cult Universe. Just to backtrack a minute on Dallas On Air, that's 9:30, 10:30 a.m. Central for Isle of Toys, because there's all kinds of 9:30 to 10:30 a.m.s. And then 10:30 to 11:30, we have the Rancor Pit Live. And Andy has been amazing making sure we've got some kind of social media presence, because I'll sort of gloss over and forget.
you can find us at HK Comics Show. Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, the whole nine yards. We are out there. We got about a weekly post right now. I'm trying to get it up to about a bi-weekly post. And then anytime anybody says anything about a Moon Knight TV show, I have to blast it out there, because stop toying with my emotions. Either do it or don't do it. Stop talking about it.
I have a feeling there's a Moon Knight episode coming up here in this show.
I can't talk about it.
Especially if we finally get the green light on what it's been hinted at teasingly.
Mark my words, I will put this right now. If they launch a Moon Knight show on Netflix, I will do some sort of review of every single episode for Vacant Comics as soon as that episode ends. I don't know what that's going to look like yet, but I will absolutely do it.
Oh, and by the way, if you do tune in, if you need any more incentive to tune in to Isle of Toys on Sunday, our own Andrew Farmer has apparently created another unboxing video that I'm very anxious to be able to encounter on the day of the show. I'm not allowed to see it before it actually airs live. So
you're not.
Definitely looking forward to seeing what's going on with the latest installment of the Legends of Andrew Farmer.
All right, well, let's let people get out of here. But let's get out of here. It's been a long run. You get out of here. You get out of here. All right, all right. Well, join us next week for more Hey Kids Comics. Buy, collect, enjoy your comics. Print media isn't dead. It just isn't good. Say goodnight, Gold.
Ain't what it used to be.
Ain't what it used to be. Good night, everyone. Old newspaper, huh? Ah. Oh, that was good. That was funny. Thank you.